Follow the news wherever you go. Check out our Twitter feed at CBS Radio News for hourly headlines and breaking news. And join the conversation by liking us on Facebook.
The explosion was a catastrophe. 11 crew members were killed, and the BP oil spill flowed for 87 days, causing environmental and economic damage from Texas to Florida. BP put up billions to pay compensation. But now, there are questions about new claims for hundreds of millions of dollars.
Do I have to prove that the oil spill directly harmed my business? The answer is no.
A business does not have to prove that their loss was directly caused by that event.
BP says it's being forced to pay people who never saw oil anywhere but on TV.
It's one of the greatest humanitarian stories you've probably never heard. In 1938, a young Londoner used his vacation to go to Czechoslovakia as the Nazis were clamping down on the country's Jews. He ended up saving the lives of 669 children. How did he do it? You'll hear all about it tonight from the man himself, who is now 105 years old.
I work on the motto that if something's not impossible, there must be a way of doing it.
9-year-old quarterback Travis Endicott, one of Steve Clarkson's newest students. If he's good enough by the ripe old age of 12, he may be offered a Division I college football scholarship.
Are they looking at 7- to 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds?
Without question, it has happened.
These wannabe Peyton Mannings are inspired by their professors, Clarkson's alumni, a roster of NFL quarterbacks who spend part of their offseason dishing out expertise to an awestruck platoon of undergraduates.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes. BP, the company responsible for the Deepwater Horizon disaster in 2010, is suddenly facing billions of dollars in higher fines. A federal judge ruled last Thursday that BP was grossly negligent in the biggest accidental oil spill the world has ever seen, and that ruling means that the fines could be quadrupled. Long before this ruling, BP had already paid billions in fines and in compensation to businesses hurt by the spill. But as we first reported in May, BP is now crying foul, claiming it's the victim of Gulf Coast swindlers who have the oil giant over a barrel. BP says it's being forced to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation to people who never saw oil anywhere but on TV.
The explosion was a catastrophe. 11 crew members were killed. The gusher flowed 87 days. BP put up billions to pay compensation and hired attorney Ken Feinberg to sort out who was hurt by the spill and who was not.
One fellow down in Alabama said to me, when I asked him for proof, he said, "Mr. Feinberg, we do things with a handshake down here." I said, "That's fine, but a handshake won't get you compensation."
Why is it so important to hold everyone to that standard of proof?
Because there'll be another catastrophe, and a catastrophe after that. What happens the next time in terms of a company's willingness to do something similar?
Feinberg has long experience. He ran the compensation program for victims of 9/11. In the BP disaster, he told us there were often two kinds of applicants, the deserving and the devious.
What was the most outrageous claim you got?
I think there was a fellow in Oslo, Norway, if I remember correctly, who slipped on the ice while he was filing a claim and sought damages for a broken leg.
People saw money and they tried to get it.
Human nature goes with the territory. I think that if you had any type of compensation program anywhere, you get a fair number of people who try and game the system to try and recover compensation.
Feinberg says out of more than a million claims, he found only a third were justified. His critics said too many claims were being denied. So to avoid decades of court battles and uncertainty, BP agreed to a more lenient compensation program. But now BP Vice President Jeff Morrell says the oil giant is getting soaked by businesses with losses that are not linked to the spill.
We're talking about a wireless phone company store that burned to the ground and shut down before the spill. An RV park owner that was foreclosed upon before the spill. And I love this one, a Pontiac dealer who could no longer sell Pontiacs because GM had discontinued the line before the spill.
Those are all real examples, and they are people who actually got a check.
Those are all real examples and are, frankly, not exceptions, but rather emblematic of a far larger problem. There are more than 1,000 claims just like them that had glaring red flags associated with them that should have been picked out by the claims administrator and instead were ultimately awarded more than $500 million.
That's how BP adds it up. But the new claims administrator, Pat Juneau, says BP is getting what it asked for. Juneau's Deepwater Horizon Claims Center replaced Ken Feinberg. Same job, new rules.
BP makes it sound like you're throwing millions of dollars away to people who have no stake in the oil spill whatsoever.
I have an obligation as a court-appointed official by the federal court to implement what these two parties wrote.
The parties are BP and, on the other side, lawyers representing victims. They negotiated a settlement with a fairly simple formula. BP agreed to pay businesses whose income dropped after the spill and then rebounded 1 year later. Trouble was, some attorneys soliciting clients took that to mean any business with a loss of any kind.
Your losses don't have to be directly traceable to the oil spill.
Do I have to prove that the oil spill directly harmed my business? The answer is no.
A business does not have to prove that their loss was directly caused by that event.
There was a proliferation of these kinds of ads, and there was almost a Pied Piper-like recruitment of claimants. And compounding that problem was the fact that the claims administrator, the facility, began to pay these claims.
One attorney's flyer reads, "The craziest thing about the settlement is that you can be compensated for losses that are unrelated to the spill." BP's attorney, Ted Olson, has a word for that.
I think that's fraud. We want to compensate legitimate claimants. But this here's an incentive to encourage people to commit fraud, and that is wrong.
So BP launched its own ad campaign, which pointed to $60,000 that went to colorectal surgeons 300 miles from the coast and $173,000 paid to an escort service in Florida. BP also claims $8 million was approved for companies that clean up after hurricanes. Their income was down after the spill because there were no hurricanes that made landfall that year. Pat Juneau, the claims administrator, told us that he questioned the eligibility formula at the start because it didn't require proof of a link to the spill. He asked BP about that, and BP replied in the court record that if the numbers fit the formula, all losses are presumed to be attributable to the oil spill, even if the decline was wholly unrelated to the oil spill. With that, Juneau decided that if a business lost money, he was not allowed to ask why.
It's a black and white formula. A deal's a deal, Scott.
Jim Roy is a lawyer for the victims. He helped negotiate the eligibility formula with BP.
Well, I think BP has buyer's remorse. BP told the court that it believed that this was going to be a $7.8 billion settlement. But I think it's going to be considerably more than the amount of money that BP said it was going to cost.
We called dozens of the applicants that BP says took unfair advantage of the deal, but all of them declined to be interviewed.
Do you think that might be because they're feeling sort of sheepish about receiving that check?
No, I think there are two things going on. I think, one, most of these businesses understand that they want their lives to stay private. And number two, the last thing they want is to go on 60 Minutes with Scott Pelley to broadcast anything about them personally.
But there could be another reason. On the claim form that applicants sign under penalty of perjury, it says that they assert economic loss due to the spill. BP lawyer Ted Olson says it shouldn't matter that the formula to calculate the loss doesn't consider the cause.
You had to have been hurt by the oil spill.
BP's accounting expert Holly Sharp testified in 2012 that once a business meets the formula, all losses are, quote, presumed to be caused by the spill with no analysis required to determine whether the declines might have been due at least in part to other causes. I mean, it just seems that that's what BP agreed to. You made your bed, and now you're lying in it.
The part that you just quoted from me started off with once you meet the formula. The formula is that, first of all, you have to establish that you're injured as a result of this. Otherwise, anyone can walk in and say, I had a bad year. Pay me money.
And that's exactly what's happening.
That's exactly what's happening.
The front page of the settlement claim form says, quote, the claim is for those that assert economic loss due to the spill. What does due to the spill mean to you?
Caused. But if they qualify, whatever that calculation is, they should be paid. You may, in hindsight, judge that just doesn't seem right. I may judge in hindsight, although I don't, that just doesn't seem right. But that's the deal BP asked for. That's the deal BP got. And the deal BP got was for the entire states of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama.
Claims Administrator Pat Janot is rejecting about 40% of claims when companies can't prove an economic loss of some kind. But he has approved more than $3 billion in claims so far.
So, in a nutshell, if they've got the right numbers, they get a check.
I'm obliged to honor and pay those claims.
BP essentially is saying that you're facilitating fraud.
I have never in my life. I'm 76 years old. I've been to a lot of rodeos in my life. I don't facilitate fraud. Fraud offends me.
But doesn't this do violence to common sense when you're paying claims to people who have no loss associated with the spill?
Well,
how could that possibly be the intent of the agreement?
You do understand that I wasn't there when these parties agreed to this agreement, and that's what they agreed to.
But no company would ever agree to a settlement that compensates people who were not harmed by their actions, and we most certainly did not agree to such a settlement.
BP doesn't like the deal it cut now. I'm sorry about that. I can't help that. But I was in the room when this section of the deal was negotiated. Others on our team were there, too. That's what we saw and heard. No doubt about it.
The battle, of course, is in the federal courts. BP has won a few on the size of some of the checks, but it's lost every attempt to reinterpret the formula that decides who's eligible.
Here in New Orleans, one federal judge said that BP was essentially trying to rewrite the deal. A federal appeals judge said that there was nothing fundamentally unreasonable about the deal that BP agreed to, but now wishes it had not. BP is now asking the appeals court for one more hearing. Is this a matter of BP's attorneys just having been hoodwinked? You accepted a deal without fully realizing what it meant, and now you're stuck with it.
No one could have anticipated that the system would go completely off the tracks. But that's why you have appellate courts, and that's why we have the Supreme Court. BP will take this as far as it is necessary to go to make sure that this settlement agreement is construed properly.
Did you guys take BP to the cleaners on this?
No, sir. BP got a good settlement, and BP was represented by very, very good lawyers who were worthy adversaries, who fought tooth and nail for their client, and it was a hard-fought settlement. Their own lawyer said it was a very generous settlement.
That's not what they're saying now.
Well,
they're saying it's a little too generous.
It is what it is.
Now, BP complains it feels like it's the visiting team fighting a home field advantage along a gulf that remembers vividly scenes like this.
If the inference is that we're giving preferential treatment and putting the screws to somebody here, myself or this court, that's grossly untrue. It's offensive, certainly offensive to me, and it shouldn't be said, and it has no place in this litigation.
Shortly after our story first aired, the Federal Appeals Court denied BP's request for another hearing on who is eligible for an award. And just this past week, BP asked another court to consider removing Pat Jeannot as the claims administrator.
Now an extraordinary story from the Second World War, a humanitarian story that didn't come to light for decades. It concerns a young Londoner named Nicholas Winton, who went to Prague and ended up saving the lives of 669 children, mostly Jews, from almost certain death. As we first reported last April, his story begins at the end of 1938 with Europe on the brink of war. In Germany, violence against Jews was escalating, and the infamous Munich Agreement paved the way for Hitler's armies to march unopposed into Czechoslovakia. In London, Nicholas Winton had been following events and knew that refugees fleeing the Nazis were in dire straits. He went to Czechoslovakia to see if there was anything he could do to help. What's strange is that for almost 50 years, he hardly told anyone about what he'd accomplished. And for 50 years, the children knew nothing about who had saved them or how. We begin on October 1st, 1938. Nazi troops marched into the Sudetenland, the German-speaking region of Czechoslovakia. Prague, the Czech capital, was flooded with desperate people trying to escape. A fortunate few were able to send their children abroad. These parents, mostly Czech Jews, sensed war was coming and wanted to get their children out. By chance, a cameraman filmed a man holding a boy, a 29-year-old Londoner. His name, Nicholas Winton.
All I knew was that the people that I met couldn't get out, and they were looking for ways of at least getting their children out.
Nicholas Winton is one of the few people who can bear witness to those days because he's 105 years old. He told us he went to Prague to see if he might be able to save some people.
But what made you think you could do it?
I work on the motto that if something's not impossible, there must be a way of doing it.
Back in London, Winton was a successful stockbroker living the good life with a passion for sports. But he was deeply concerned about news reports from Czechoslovakia of German persecution.
I went out into the camps where the people who had been displaced were put. And it was winter, and it was cold.
Emigration wasn't an option. The world's doors were closed to the refugees. Conditions in the camps were brutal for the 150,000 people trapped there, especially for the children. And no one focused on them until Nicholas Winton. But what did he do? We went to Jerusalem to Yad Vashem, Israel's memorial to the victims of the Holocaust, and asked Dr. David Silberklang, a senior historian there.
And Winton went, set up shop in a hotel in the center of the old city in Prague, and began looking into how can I organize getting some of these refugees, particularly the children, out of here.
What kind of experience did he have to qualify him for this immense bureaucratic task?
None.
Winton set up a small organization with one aim, to get as many kids out as fast as possible.
People started coming to him in increasing numbers. He didn't have time in the day to meet them all. He'd work till 2 in the morning, get up early in the morning to meet the next people. As more and more were coming, saying, take my child, take my child.
By the time he returned to London, he had a list of hundreds of children and set out to convince British authorities to take him seriously. He did it by taking stationery from an established refugee organization, adding children's section, and making himself chairman.
So that eventually they had to adopt me.
So, in fact, you managed to do what you did through a little deception, a little smoke and mirrors.
Yes, to a certain extent, yes.
It required quite a bit of ingenuity.
No, it just acquired a printing press to get the notepaper printed.
The children's section operated from a tiny office in central London. Winton's mother was in charge. The staff were all volunteers. During the day, Winton worked as a stockbroker. Evenings, he wrestled with the British bureaucracy.
Did you approach any other countries to take some of the children?
The Americans. But the Americans wouldn't take any, which was a pity. We could have got a lot more out.
Winton had written President Roosevelt asking the U.S. to take in more children. A minor official at the U.S. Embassy in London wrote back the U.S. was unable to help. Britain agreed to accept the children, but only if Winton found families willing to take them in. So he circulated the children's pictures to advertise them. But even after a family chose a child, British authorities were slow in issuing travel documents, so Winton started having them forged. He also spread some money around.
Took a bit of blackmail on my part.
You were indulging in blackmail and forgery to get the children out.
I've never heard it put like that before.
But you seem to be enjoying it.
It worked, that's the main thing.
The first 20 children left Prague on March 14, 1939. The next day, German troops occupied Prague and the rest of Czechoslovakia. Hitler rode through the streets triumphant. Hugo Meisel was 10 years old.
Do you remember the Germans coming into Czechoslovakia?
Not only do I remember, I personally saw Hitler standing up in the car, and the children were expected to say Heil Hitler and so forth. I remember as if yesterday.
It wasn't long before violence against Jews, property confiscations, and forced labor that began in the Sudetenland spread throughout Czechoslovakia. But the Nazis allowed Winton's trains to leave, in keeping with their policy to cleanse Europe of Jews. Hugo Meisel's parents decided it was time to put him and his brother on one of the trains.
I remember that they told us that we were going to England, maybe 2 or 3 months. It would be a holiday for us, and that they would join us very shortly thereafter.
And you believed them?
Absolutely.
Were your parents emotional when they said goodbye to you?
No, I've asked myself that question many times. How my parents had the strength It never occurred to me that what they were saying to us was not true. In other words, that they realized that they would not be joining us within a short period of time.
Over the spring and summer of 1939, 7 trains carried over 600 children through the heart of Nazi Germany to Holland, where they took a ferry to the English coast. From there, they caught a train to London. An 8th train, carrying 250 more, was scheduled to leave Prague on September 1st. But that's the day the war began.
They were all at the station, even on the train, waiting to go. And war was declared, so the train never left. Never heard, really, what happened to all those children.
But there's reason to suspect that not many of them survived.
I think that's true, yes.
2 years after that last train, the Nazis began implementing the final solution, their plan to slaughter all the Jews of Europe. Czech Jews were rounded up and shipped to Theresienstadt, an old military garrison town about an hour north of Prague, their first stop on the road to annihilation. These tracks were the exit from Theresienstadt, the only exit. The tracks led east. The trains were called Polish transports. Destination, Auschwitz. Some 90,000 people took that one-way ride. Among them, almost all the children Sir Nicholas wasn't able to get out in time. Their parents and the parents of the children already in England.
After the war, you went back to Czechoslovakia. Was there one instant where you accepted the fact that your parents were dead?
When films were being shown of people walking in concentration camps, Auschwitz and so forth. There's so many shots being taken by the Germans and so forth. Never stopped looking.
The name of every Czech Jew murdered in the Holocaust is painted on the walls of Prague's Pinkus Synagogue. Over 77,300 names, including Arnoshka and Pavel Meisel, Hugo's parents. And Nicholas Winton? During the war, he volunteered for an ambulance unit for the Red Cross, then trained pilots for the Royal Air Force. He got married, raised a family, earned a comfortable living. For 50 years, he told hardly anyone what he had done.
I didn't really keep it secret. I just didn't talk about it.
All this time, you're in England, then you go back to Czechoslovakia, then you go to Israel. You still had no idea how your departure from Czechoslovakia had been organized.
Absolutely no idea.
And you learned that by seeing it on television.
That's right.
In 1988, the BBC learned about Winton's story and invited him to be part of a program. He had no idea that the people sitting around him were people he had saved.
Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please? Mr. Winton, would you like to turn round? On behalf of all of them, thank you very much indeed.
I suppose it was the most emotional moment of my life, suddenly being confronted with all these children who weren't by any means children anymore.
No, they weren't, and for the first time, they looked at you and knew that you were the reason that they were alive.
Yeah. True.
I wore this around my neck, and this is the actual pass that we were given to come to England. And I'm another of the children that you saved.
Lady Milena Grenfell Baines describes Winton as one of the most modest people she's ever met.
Why do you think he didn't say anything for 50 years?
I think it was in his nature. He really felt that he'd done all he could, and having got those children settled, he felt, been there, done that, my job's done, I've got other things to do.
Other things. For the last 50 years, Winton's been helping mentally handicapped people and building homes for the elderly.
We've just opened our second old people's home, and it's full. And it's doing very well. And there are plenty of old people like me to go in.
But you're not there, you're at home.
Oh, I'd hate to go into one of my own homes. Don't print that.
Sir Nicholas Winton. In 2003, Winton was knighted and became Sir Nicholas Winton. In the Czech Republic, he's become a national hero. He was celebrated in a documentary called Nicky's Family, but he isn't really comfortable with all the adulation.
I'm not interested in the past. I think there's too much emphasis nowadays on the past and what has happened, and nobody is concentrating on the present and the future.
In 1939, Nicholas Winton used a two-week vacation to go to Prague and ended up saving the lives of 669 children. In the decades since, of course, the children had children, who then had children, and so on. And the numbers multiplied.
I want to summarize it in one sentence. A guy takes a two-week vacation
and ends up with 15,000 children. Yeah. Yes.
It's a pretty good story.
It's a great story.
They've got children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
And none of them would be here if it hadn't been
for Sir Nick.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Terrible responsibility, isn't
it? Quarterbacks are the superheroes of one of America's favorite pastimes. You fathers out there might have once dreamt of becoming one of those cool commanders of the gridiron. Your sons might now dream of future glory. Tonight, we meet the man who sometimes makes their dreams come true, Steve Clarkson, quarterback guru, the man parents of 8 and 9-year-olds turn to, and despite the obvious dangers of the game, spend tens of thousands of dollars seeking the magic touch that sent more than 25 Clarkson quarterbacks to the NFL. And as Morley Safer reported last December, Clarkson is so successful that college recruiters are offering football scholarships to some of his students, some as young as 13.
Steelers territory, love it or leave it.
Let's go. 1, 2, 3,
Steelers!
It all starts here in the Pee Wee League. These mini monsters games are the NFL in miniature. From cheerleaders to bone-crunching tackles. 9-year-old quarterback Travis Endicott, one of Steve Clarkson's newest students. If he's good enough by the ripe old age of 12, he may be offered a Division I college football scholarship.
Are they looking at 7- and 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds?
Without question, it has happened, and that is the new line, so to speak.
The new normal.
The new normal.
A little faster now, you guys, a little bit more comfortable. Spin it!
These wannabe Peyton Mannings are inspired by their professors. Clarkson's alumni, a roster of NFL quarterbacks who spend part of their offseason dishing out expertise to an awestruck platoon of undergraduates.
My biggest success stories are the guys that come back, whether it's Ben Roethlisberger, Matt Leinart, Jimmy Clausen, you know, Josh Freeman, Jake Locker. They all come back and they participate and they help take these kids and share their experiences as to what it was like when they were, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old.
12-year-old Aaron McLaughlin is one of Clarkson's promising new prospects.
Good. You want to be able to step completely square, close off, so that back hip catches what? That front leg, and then you finish square to your target.
Stay. 4. Post.
Well done.
Aaron's father, Craig McLaughlin, takes his son from Atlanta to Los Angeles once a month for private lessons.
It should be continuous. So when I get to here, it should just see how tight I kept this. And I stayed right up on top, and I'm here.
At $400 an hour, apart from the inherent dangers of football, it's a risky investment. There's only a 6% chance of making a college football team, and then only 8 and 10,000 will make it to the pros.
Whose idea was it to bring Clarkson into your lives?
That was actually my idea. My son is now going into the sixth grade, and he'd always shown talent in his position as a quarterback. But I really wanted to understand how talented he was and get someone that had national exposure and the experience that Steve has with quarterbacks and see how Aaron evaluated.
And how much of a change have you noticed in your talents since you started with him?
I've noticed a big change. I've been throwing the ball better. My footwork has been better. I used to kind of trip myself when I do drops. I haven't done that at all.
It's a major financial commitment for you and your family, correct?
Correct. I don't know what the future has to hold, but the one thing is that he's going to know that his parents, when he set his mind to something, we believe in him, and he's going to have that sense of confidence.
That sense of confidence that inspires parents and kids has a lot to do with the college scholarship offers that Clarkson's orchestrated for 7th and 8th graders. Last year, Clarkson secured a scholarship offer from the University of Washington for 14-year-old Tate Martell.
My goal was always to try to get a scholarship, and when it came, I was just shocked.
How long is it that you wanted to be a big-time quarterback?
I talked about the NFL when I was like 4 years old. I guess I'd run around my house. I see pictures of me running around my house in a 49ers helmet, butt naked.
That naked passion eventually led Tate's parents to seek out Clarkson. How did it affect your game?
Oh, I've improved in, like, massive ways, especially my ability to play consistently throughout the game. especially like in the fourth quarter, being able to throw the same way I do in the first, like I do in the fourth.
When you got this offer, you weren't even in high school yet.
Yeah.
Correct?
I was going into eighth grade.
It may be a man's game, but the mamas are just as passionate as the papas. Pamela Poe's son, MC Poe, is a junior and starting quarterback for Cathedral High School in Los Angeles, an NFL-sized squad with 16, repeat, 16 coaches. Do you worry about him when he's on the field?
I do. I'm his mom. Of course I do. That's why I told him he's got to have speed and get out of the way.
2 years ago, Ms. Poe sent her son from Nashville to Los Angeles to live with the Clarkson family. A lot of mothers are going to look at you and say, you know, what gives with her? I mean, the dangers of the game, after all, it's only a game. And isn't it a bit excessive?
This is a passion that MC has had. And when I have a child that had the opportunity to come out to California and train to develop himself into being a better quarterback, I do not feel that it was excessive because it was the right thing for MC.
But what people might find excessive is you took him out of school and sent him to California to live with Steve.
MC's a different child. Here he is, 14 years old, left his family, his brothers, his friends, but he knew he wanted to do this. He was that driven. That's the kind of child MC is.
One of Clarkson's students, who's already had a scholarship offer, is 17-year-old Brady White.
Let's go!
White is ranked among the top 100 high school quarterbacks in the country.
Look at this.
Under those Friday night lights, Clarkson shuttles between his students' games.
Brady is a once-in-a-lifetime kid. His skill set is really one of the best I've seen.
Music to your ears, right?
Right. It's a dream to hear that, and you hope that it comes true. Steve's a lot of the reason why Brady has mechanics and the talent and the passion that he does.
Andrea and Darren White, Brady's parents, are Clarkson faithfuls. But this is a dangerous game, and the quarterback is always the guy with a target on his chest, right?
Driving down the street's a dangerous event in California as well. So how many people get to play and start at quarterback in high school and then go on to college and play in front of millions of fans, in front of TV and the environment?
I mean,
yeah, that's a dream come true.
Here we go.
Clarkson's job is to feed the football machine.
All right, now we're getting somewhere.
With a new crop of dreamers.
Nice shot.
It's a well-oiled machine of camps and clinics where you can learn fancy footwork and an exotic language.
We didn't see it. Now I take the three and then bang, hit it in the second window.
He teaches 40 or 50 kids at a time, employing a routine of skills and drills.
And then boom.
From proper poses.
Boom.
To pirouettes.
That's it. Spin it.
All in the name of perfecting the pass.
Woo, damn.
And he briefs parents on the risky road to stardom.
They're going to read about their son. They're going to go to a game, and they're going to hear awful things about their son. Like, I remember my dad telling me one time I was so bad at a game at Fresno State, I threw 5 interceptions. He had to boo, too, just so that he wouldn't get beat up. So, you know, I know, it's tough. We call this a single high beam.
That firsthand knowledge of failure led to Clarkson's success as a teacher.
When I started this business, there was nobody that did this. There were tennis coaches. There were batting coaches. There were pitching coaches. But there was never a quarterback coach. It was not just teaching the art of quarterbacking, but it was also kind of a creative marketing. Like, how do you take this guy and make him a star?
What's going on, man?
Star making through college connections. College coaches like Steve Sarkisian, a Clarkson graduate and new head coach at USC, want to know about his newest batch of talent. In Clarkson's 25 years of training, over 100 of his clients have made it as Division I college or NFL quarterbacks.
Take care. Good luck now.
Clarkson was one of the nation's top quarterbacks at San Jose State, but just couldn't make it to the NFL. So he went into the guru business, and word soon spread about his success. Parents across the country sought him out, among them Joe Montana, who sent his two sons to the Clarkson camp. That's some endorsement.
some NFL fathers aren't so keen about football for kids, period. Bart Scott, a CBS Sports Network analyst, played for 11 years as an NFL linebacker.
Roethlisberger goes down!
And was a quarterback's worst nightmare.
And what a violent hit Ben took.
One of your prime jobs was to sack the quarterback.
Inflict pain. That was my job description.
Well, you sure inflicted pain on Ben Roethlisberger. That kind of determination to inflict pain, as you say, does that apply to kids' football as well?
Of course, especially. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I started playing football when I was 8 years old. You know, we used to come back and show the opposing team's colors that, you know, that had rubbed off on our helmets, meaning that we had really hit them really good. It was a badge of honor.
Scott had no interest in that badge of honor for his son. He went on the record saying he didn't want his kid playing football.
Listen, get a little steam.
So how can you let your kid play football?
You know what? You know, I didn't want my son to play football, but when my son wanted to play and his mother signed him up, what I decided to do was become the football coach so I can make sure that he's been taught the proper techniques to defend himself, to protect himself.
What worries parents most is the risk of brain injury. Nevertheless, as these high school hardest hits videos show, the kids themselves do not hold back. Beyond the dangers of the game, Scott worries about the impact of big college football's latest recruiting tactic. Get them while they're young.
Universities and people who are in that business will stop at anything to make a profit. You know, everybody wants to be ahead of the curve. I remember the kid, Tyson Jackson, I believe, out of LSU, received a scholarship when he was born because he was a 10-pound baby. I'm like, really? Like, how do you know this kid doesn't have two left feet?
Actually, it was a 15-pound baby named Herman Johnson. The scholarship offer may be a myth, but Johnson did grow up to become a 400-pound guard with a scholarship from LSU.
Set, go.
But your football scholarship is just about as rare as your 15-pound baby. And Clarkson may love the game, but
this is a very, very tough racket.
There's no question it's tough, but it's no different than from the person that wants to be an actor. And they go to school for that, and chances are they're going to be serving coffee at Starbucks or someplace.
Do you prepare them for disappointment?
You don't ever really prepare for disappointment. I think what you try to do is you're preparing them for multiple choices so that you know, hey, look, you're always taught as a quarterback, we go to the line of scrimmage and we see one thing, but we have to be prepared to change the play.
I'm Leslie Stahl. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.